From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour is being made across the country in every municipality with the police department. The role of police is, of course, to protect the public. And in the wake of events in Ferguson and St. Louis, Missouri, we're taking a close look at police action, the use of military-style gear and weaponry, what kind of action is appropriate when officers are in dangerous situations. This is, of course, a vital conversation to have, but it's also a difficult conversation to have without voices from the law enforcement community. And today we're pleased to welcome a panel that will offer diverse perspectives on policing. This hour, we welcome Professor Mark Concordia, who is a Robert Wesleyan College professor in the Department of Criminal Justice. He's the director of the Criminal Justice Administration's program, spent 13 years with the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force, worked in corrections, federal law enforcement, and locally with the Greece Police Department. When did you officially retire, by the way?
July 9th of this year.
Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Still fresh off your retirement there.
Still relevant.
But still working, of course. Professor Marvin Stefferson is here. He's also with Robert Wesleyan College. Professor Stefferson has helped develop a curriculum for an ethics and social diversity course at RWC and recently retired from the Rochester Police Department after many years of service in some of the most challenged neighborhoods in Rochester. Your retirement, Professor Stefferson, from RPD was when?
July 31st.
Wow, we have two fresh retirees. And a man who has not retired after 29 years is David Morabito. He's been in private practice in law for the past 29 years, the general area of concentration, criminal law in federal and state courts, and he's handled an estimated 15,000 cases, Dave?
Approximately, that's correct.
And you haven't retired yet?
No, I've got a few more years to go.
Approximately 15,000 cases, including many cases involving police, questions about use of force, that kind of thing, fair to say?
Well, many of my cases over the years have all dealt with, obviously, law enforcement, every gambit you can imagine. And I've had many clients arrested pursuant to SWAT teams. That's not uncommon for the type of cases that I deal with.
Okay. And so we're going to want to hear from you this hour, no matter where you're listening, wherever you are, whether you're in the Finger Lakes, Rochester, listening online, sneaking in connections at work, we'd love to hear from you. The number's toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. And let me get right to the panel's reactions on what we're seeing in across the country, the demonstrations, whether it's in Ferguson or solidarity demonstrations, et cetera. And Professor Concordia had emailed me to say, you know, let's make sure we include law enforcement voices in this conversation, which I said, that's wonderful, because, Mark, as you know, we don't want to vilify police, but I also understand why it's been difficult to get police to come on the show and talk, because they want to feel that the public is not attacking them for what they feel is doing their job, I guess is fair to say.
Yes, I mean, regardless of what lens you decide to try to analyze this event through, it's important that we have to understand a couple of things. One is that there is a current crisis of trust between the many communities, especially our challenged communities, and law enforcement. And one way that we can help pick away at that crisis of trust is through informative discussions, education, and bringing some of the misperceptions about use of force or about issues like military gear within police departments to light, to discuss them and try to have a perspective that's both sides can understand.
All right. So the bottom line is no one wants to see the events that we've seen unfold necessarily, but there is a chance for a productive conversation.
I think that has to be a productive conversation. This issue is very divisive, and we cannot have a dualistic analysis of this.
Professor Marvin Stefferson, what's your take so far on what you've seen in the events in Ferguson and some of these demonstrations? Give me a sense for your outlined response to this so far.
Pretty much what I'm taking from the whole chain of events is that, transparency, the lack thereof. Right now you have several incidents that have taken place across the country where police communications have broken down between them and the citizens. And when the department took the stance of coming forward with information, explaining, policy and procedure, how the officers are supposed to respond and whatnot, then things have, come to a head quicker, whether or not they're going to protest or riot. But with Missouri, you see the officers' administration has shut down as far as opening up to what the officer did or did not do, whether it's within policy guideline or things that they're taking as far as measures to resolve the issue. They haven't come forward with anything, and that's the biggest problem that you see a lot of the citizens over there and across the country are having issue with, is that we don't know what has taken place in the store before the incident, or what the officer did, whether it was a good thing or not so good. So that's the problem that they're experiencing now.
Transparency. People feel like they're being either lied to or things are being hidden from them.
Right. I mean, you got to go with the tradition of the black community, if I can speak frankly, and that is that law enforcement has always been something that was used as a social control agent for the black community. And so when it came to a point where officers of color were allowed to be a part of the organization that was always some symbol of mistrust or distrust, now you have X amount of years that they have to try and, dismiss or clear away. It's hard to unprogram that type of behavior that departments have had against the black community. So now when you have things that are kind of suspect or don't seem to be right within the community, then the biggest thing that departments can do is try to explain rather than dismiss or shut them back into a corner like a little child and say, hey, just sit there and wait for us to respond to you when we feel like it. No, you have to respect them as their community, as any community, and give them some answers so that they can try to digest and understand what's taking place.
And again, Professor Stepherson has years of experience policing in Rochester. We're going to be talking in this hour about that issue of relationships, particularly with the black community, perceptions that are out there. And we're going to get back to that point in just a second. Let me ask Dave Morabito, do you look at what's happened in Ferguson from your perspective as an attorney? Look, Dave, I know people may not like to hear this, but I'm trying not to judge the actual incident without hearing more. And like Professor Stepherson said, I want more information too, and I think we'll eventually get it. Have you drawn any conclusions about the incident? I'm not talking about the aftermath, and I'm not talking about the way the city and the departments there have behaved. The incident itself, are there more questions that you want answered, or are you concerned about what you've seen?
Well, I'm concerned about everything, but I would note that I've spent my entire adult life analyzing, critiquing, deciphering actions of law enforcement. That's what I literally do in every case, every day, every minute. I'm reviewing what occurred. And I am not against the use of force when it's necessary by law enforcement. A SWAT team could be very, very important in a particular situation, not only protect their own safety, law enforcement safety, but also a SWAT team, when they're entering a home, they're also protecting the people inside from committing acts that could be violent in nature or that could be very harmful to themselves. So it's a case-by-case basis. I'm not familiar with the intimate details of what occurred in Ferguson, but I wish there was a lot more transparency. I wish law enforcement did come out quicker with all the facts that they were aware of.
Go ahead, Mark.
Yeah, to expound on that point, there really is no script for these things. I mean, these are events that are critical in our community and our society, but there really is no script for senior administrators, unfortunately. And I think today in the information age, more than ever, there has to be increased training and education about this. The first hours following the shooting, it was imperative that the police department should have, I'm not sure if they did or not, I'm not privy to it, but should have reached out to the community as quickly as possible. Because what was circulating amongst the community were images of Michael Brown's body on social media and the lack of information from the police about what happened. And in this information age, it's a new age of policing, intelligence-led policing, technology, video cell phone cameras everywhere, surveillance cameras everywhere. Law enforcement has a duty. Senior administrators have a duty to become involved quickly and be as transparent as they can. And it's not a normal situation. We understand, you want to hide behind the guise of, this is an investigation, we need to keep things quiet. But in terms, when you take a life of a member of society, you need to be scrutinized from the moment that happens to months down the road before they even panel a grand jury to hear the case. So the response, I think, has to be better from our administrators, our senior-level law enforcement administrators.
All right, so we've seen, Mark referenced the video of Michael Brown's body that's been going on. We don't have video, to my knowledge, of the actual shooting and death of Michael Brown. There was an event in St. Louis where a man holding a knife came at police officers during the afternoon and was yelling, shoot me, shoot me. And eventually they did. They fired from and that's on video, and we've seen it. What I could hear, maybe 7 to 10 shots, a couple of shots after he had fallen to the ground. But again, he's holding a knife, he's coming at officers, etc. So we can at least see it in that case. In the Michael Brown case, we don't have the video of it. And one of the questions is, should officers wear cameras now? And let's hear, I'd love to hear what the panel says. Mark, you're immediately nodding. Yes?
Absolutely yes. I think, you know, as I discussed earlier, with the prevalence of security video cameras out there, the prevalence of the technology where everybody has a cell phone and there's taking various angles and audio and dubbed in audio of what's happening, I think that it's imperative that law enforcement officers be fitted with body cameras. And so we can, in situations like this, the ambiguity of the incident can immediately be scrutinized, and whether it's a good shoot or a bad shoot, it doesn't matter. The video camera will tell the facts of the story. I think it's important. And, you know, there was a debate about this years ago when a lot of law enforcement agencies went to videotaping suspect interrogations. There was a lot of resistance to that. Mm-hmm. And I'll admit, I was one of them saying, I'm not sure if this is good or bad. But once we instituted that policy, it was a tremendous benefit for law enforcement and for the criminal justice system altogether, even for lawyers. Because we have to understand that the police officers in today's world, we don't have that aura of, I guess, absolute credibility that we used to. And that's unfortunate, because there's been actions, deviant behavior by police officers, or incidents like this that spur debate and divisive issues. But that camera is going to tell the facts. And more defense attorneys, great defense attorneys like Mr. Morbido, would be able to go after our suspect confessions. And there was a lot of false confessions that were happening, and there was a lot of issues and a lot of education scholarship around that really are forcing a lot of the police departments in the right direction to videotape that. So it was initially, I was not for that. I was a little concerned, but it was tremendous. And I think we need to do the same thing here.
I want to get the others' take on that, but real briefly, Mark, I know you've looked into it. Is this something that departments could afford, and is the camera cumbersome?
Well, there's the question. There's certain departments that are already deploying it. The New York State Police use it. I know the Gates Police Department uses it. And I believe potentially the Town of Greece Police Department may be looking into it. The issue is cost, because not only do you have to initially purchase the cameras, but you have to maintain the video.
Yeah.
And you should maintain it for an indefinite period of time, because you never know when an accusation is going to come up. In the vast majority of cases, these videos will protect the officer and protect the citizen from either the manifestation of an implicit or explicit bias.
Gotcha. Marvin Stefferson, cameras on police, you agree?
Oh, certainly.
Yeah?
Certainly. I mean, you know, you have to look at it two ways, like Mark was saying. You know, it protects the officer. It also protects the citizen. But more importantly, the situation of the stop or the interaction. You know, a lot of times officers find themselves going to internal affairs off of lies that citizens have produced against the officer, because it is common knowledge within certain environments or certain places in the city where police have been accused of actions. They've formed a litigation against the department. And
did that ever happen to you?
No. No, fortunately, thank God, I knocked wood on that.
But you've seen it happen. Yeah.
I've seen it happen. I've talked with other officers before I retired, you know, that had to go and testify to protect their name, the action, and they found themselves being sued. And then the city pays these persons that put this lawsuit against the officers because they didn't have enough information to unfound it. So rather than call the citizen a liar, because, again, the department doesn't want to put that stigma out there, they will just pay the person. And so then that becomes common knowledge, and you see those types of things being practiced.
Yeah. Dave Morbido, as an attorney, yes or no to police wearing cameras?
Well, I have different views depending on a particular case that I'm involved with. There are certain times I wish there was a video to document exactly what happened. Other times I wish there was no video and there was one. So there are pros and cons from a criminal defense point of view as to whether it's beneficial or not. I would note that back in the late 80s and early 90s, all the local agencies had They were videotaping DWI arrests. And after we started analyzing, reviewing the videos, we realized that the testimony may not have been consistent with the video. And a lot of defense attorneys were winning cases at that point, and that's when, to my understanding, videos were stopped. So there's pros to cons to everything. Now, obviously, if we're talking about a violent felony offense, a video would be very helpful to assist the grand jury, a jury, judges, district attorneys, defense attorneys. Overall, I'm sure a video is probably in everyone's best interest. Also, I think it keeps people in line when they know they're being videotaped. Not only law enforcement, but also the defendants themselves or family members. When everybody knows that they're going to be on the air, I think people take a different attitude, and it may be more civil for everyone involved.
We also had a question from a listener last week, and it was the same kind of question that I've had and I am ignorant about. And I know that Marvin and Mark, again, retired police officers with years in law enforcement, can help understand this. When you look at that video in St. Louis of the police shooting the man holding a knife, he's coming at them with a knife. He's not running, but he's walking. He's yelling, "Shoot me!" They have to make a difficult decision there. They choose to engage their firearm. A listener said, can't they just shoot to disable? Can't they take the guy down without killing them? And look, I've had the same question because I'm ignorant. I haven't gone through police training myself. So let's get this out of the way. I'll start with you, Marvin. When it comes to discharging your weapon, is there a realistic notion of shoot to disable versus shoot for lethal or to take someone down?
No.
No distinction.
No distinction whatsoever. I mean, you can take your most highly qualified marksman, shoot 98% hit ratio, put them in a high stress situation in between, the officer, physiological being at that time, stress, caffeine, anything is going to decrease that marksmanship. You know, we're talking the stress effects of your eyes, your ears. All of this comes into play when you're shooting a weapon. Now you're talking about a distance of beyond 4 feet, 7 feet, 10 feet, 15 feet. The average shooting itself takes place within 7 to 2 feet of an officer. These types of things are played out in movies and TV shows, and, you know, it's scripted. They're going to shoot, they're going to hit, and the person goes down with the wound, and all is well. But in a real scenario, when you have an officer out there, depending on whether they're on sleep deprivation, they have caffeine in their system, or the stress itself affects them negatively physically, they're going to have their shooting percentage drop. And if they're trying to shoot at an extremity, being an arm and a leg,
yep,
your chance of hitting is greatly diminished.
And your chances of losing your own life probably go up.
Right, because now we're talking about, again, that close proximity of you and the suspect. So we always train as a firearms instructor that you went for center mass. That's your largest area to strike. And unfortunately, you know, the results may be tragic. You know, it may be the loss of life. But again, this is a deadly force situation. So this is the last resort. And so therefore, shooting at that area is what we train to do. It's what they're supposed to do. And that's how to respond accordingly.
Mark?
Just to expound on Professor Sefferson's point there, the National Institute of Justice came out with a report. They studied 113 incidents involving officer-involved shootings, and their conclusions were most officers reported that just before and as they pulled the trigger on the suspect, they experienced a range of physiological, emotional, and psychological reactions to include heightened visual detail, auditory blunting, visual distortions, and in extreme cases, police officers didn't even recall firing their gun. So there's another point that's often brought up. And when we talk about deadly physical force situations, is the amount of bullets that were fired. As Professor Severson was stating, you know, when we're trained to continue to, if we're deploying our weapon system, we are confronted with deadly physical force. We feel our lives or the life of another individual is in danger. So we have to meet that force with the equal force. Mm-hmm. And we're trained to continue to use that force until the threat is ceased. And that doesn't mean, even if the person is on the ground, maybe, potentially, and has a weapon, or we think they has a weapon, and they're moving around, that could cause the officer to fire another shot. And I also hear sometimes in this discourse about the use of less than lethal options. And it's a valid question. But in a lot of these circumstances where deadly physical force is used, the situation goes from zero to extreme very quickly. And if an officer is by himself at the scene and he's faced with deadly physical force, there's no training that's going to tell him to use a less than lethal at that point. You have to meet that force. Now, if there's other officers, one may be able to deploy a less than lethal option, but that's also dependent and fact-based.
Dave Morabito, did you want to weigh in on that as well?
Well, you know, as a criminal defense attorney, you get involved after the fact. I'm reviewing reports that were prepared hours after the fact, weeks after the fact, and it's very easy for me to critique and or criticize others. But you've got to remember, law enforcement are placed in a position where it's instantaneous reaction. An entire incident might last 2 seconds. And law enforcement officers, obviously, like every citizen in our country, every person has a right to defend themselves. And they're placed in very precarious, very dangerous situations. Hopefully, no one will ever be placed in that position. But it's really hard for me to comprehend the stress that they're facing in that instant. And it's a life and death decision that has to be made instantaneously. And I don't care how well our law enforcement officers are prepared, to put somebody in that situation is really kind of stunning. And I can understand why things have happened.
Let's go ahead and grab our first phone call. This is Bernard in Fairport. I want to remind Bernard and our listening audience who is with us on this panel. We've got Professor Mark Concordia with Roberts Wesleyan College, the director of the Criminal Justice Administration Program. He spent 13 years with the FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force and recently retired finally from law enforcement, was with the Greece Police Department. Professor Marvin Stefferson is with us, also Roberts Wesleyan College, and among other things, recently retired from the Rochester Police Department after many years of service to some of the most challenged neighborhoods in the city. David Morabito is an attorney in the Rochester area. He's been in private practice for the past 29 years. Bernard in Fairport, thanks for calling. Go ahead.
Yeah, what I'm interested in is the how this whole thing fits in the context. For example, are we suffering more violence in the U.S. this year than we did 2 years ago? Are we focusing on these particular sad instances of policemen having to use physical force and killing people? Is that really becoming a big problem? And in that same respect, is the fact that we no longer have the proper health care, medical care, or mental care that we need, and there's more guns in society? So I'd just be interested in the context of this story. And thanks very much for the show.
Thank you, Bernard. Well, how about when it comes to mental care, et cetera? David, you've worked for 29 years in private practice with clients. You've dealt with people from a variety of backgrounds. Are we in worse shape when it comes to mental care and services to help people than we were 20, 30 years ago?
Actually, I have a few more years than that. I was a public defender for a number of years, then went into private practice for 29 years.
I didn't mean to demote you or short you.
I honestly think that our society is becoming much more violent, and it's been continuing since I started in 81. And it's very unfortunate. There's probably many different factors that go into this. Obviously, poverty is one, but education is important. Education can take people out of the realm of being in an awkward position or being a victim of poverty or subjected to poverty. And what I found was interesting, when I first started my practice, I was dealing with people my age at that time, and their parents may have had they may have been somewhat impoverished because I was a public defender, but they still had respect, dignity, character, perseverance, trustworthiness. And I feel that our society for the last 30 years has been becoming so violent. It's really stunning. The city of Rochester, and people may agree or disagree, but we have a pretty violent city. We have really a lot of places that somebody could be victimized very easy, and we have to go back to the basics. And I think education is very important. We have to have parents become parents. So there's many, many different factors that will affect why we have a horrendous crime rate in Rochester and in the United States of America. I personally think we need more law enforcement at many different levels, at the national, state, local level. I would like to see more law enforcement out in the public, in the neighborhoods. I'd like to see the city of Rochester have smaller precincts where the law enforcement are neighbors, friends of the citizens of the community. So that's a question that I'm sure there's a lot of professors a lot brighter than I am that could, that
well,
could do something.
Let me also say, Dave, that last week on this program, Mayor Lovely Warren was here, and she mentioned that there is a reorganization happening that especially next year we're going to see it rolled out where it's back to more of the sections, I think five sections in the city as opposed to two big headings of that, with the goal of getting closer to the neighborhoods and more establishing more of a rapport. And so, you know, I don't know if that works. But
well, you know, it's interesting. I think I communicate with my clients very well, and I communicate with their families. And what's interesting, I may be representing someone as a criminal defendant, but when I'm talking to the families, I get the impression that the families, I'm talking about the average person out in the neighborhood in some sections of our community, they would like much more law enforcement presence. People have advised me they would not have a problem with the National Guard on every corner to preserve the peace. So it's an interesting concept. I think the residents of the city of Rochester and all the outlying areas, they want civility. They want peace. They don't want their nephews killed at a grocery store. They don't want to be victims of violent crime. I think the average person in our communities want law and order, and they support law and order. And they support not only law and order, but they'll support the district attorneys that are prosecuting these violent felonies. We're in a very awkward situation, unfortunately, where a lot of people are afraid to come forward to report crimes, to assist law enforcement. Mm-hmm. And that just degrades our entire community and society.
Let me ask the officers here a question that hit the front page of the Democrat and Chronicle on Saturday. It's a question that's come up since Ferguson, and it's the word is militarization. I think that some may view that as hyperbole, but the question is, do police need military-style gear? Rochester has, for example, as Jim Goodman reported in the Democrat and Chronicle, an MRAP. Mark, what's an MRAP?
An MRAP is a mobile. It is a mine-resistant, ambush-protected armored vehicle.
All right, mine-resistant. So this is where the cynics say, there's no mines on the city of Rochester. We're not, but maybe I'm wrong. We're not Afghanistan. Why are police rolling around in military gear? They're not doing it every day. But let's ask the retired officers here, and I'll start with Mark Concordia. Do police need this kind of gear?
Yes. Now, let me qualify. Police need this type of gear not only to keep themselves safe, but the community safe. But on the other hand, there has to be a judicious application and use of those vehicles, of that type of equipment. It does send a strong message, and sometimes that's a good message when you're trying to defuse a very disorderly situation. But other times, if it's misused, and law, you know, common law enforcement parlance may be able to justify a lot of reasons why to use it for officer safety or what have you, but it has to be used for specific purposes. And It has a utility, especially in a post 9/11 world, especially when we have this phenomenon of attended violence manifesting in active shooter incidents that are occurring on an alarming basis in today's society. These incidents are very fluid, and they're very, very dangerous. And often IEDs are employed. There is a percentage where some of these active shooters have either made IEDs or at least threatened IEDs. Improvised explosive devices.
Yes, it's essentially a mine. So an MRAP may actually be perfectly appropriate there.
Absolutely, especially when you're dealing also with high-risk warrants. When you're executing high-risk arrest warrants or search warrants, oftentimes some of these drug houses in the city are barricaded where police officers could stand out there for hours trying to break a door down. That's not going to happen. And sometimes they're actually booby-trapped, especially when you talk about some of the domestic terrorism investigations that I have some training in. They're very, very proficient in the production of IEDs.
Have you ever seen an incident, either in your own department or one that you're watching colleagues go out in, where you said to yourself, that kind of gear is not appropriate right now?
I have not. Now, I was in a suburban department for most of my career, and I worked in the federal law enforcement community with the counterterrorism. And when we deployed that type of equipment, it was a high-risk situation.
Right.
So, you know, we didn't really deal with a lot of social or civil unrest in my experience, so I might not be the best person to answer that.
Before I get over to Marvin Stefferson and his experience in Rochester, you talk about what's sort of appropriate and not. When you see officers in camouflage gear, that's sort of instantly gets your adrenaline up. And what are police in Ferguson? Are there jungles in Ferguson that I did not know about? I mean, why were they wearing camo? Is that to send a message? Because if that sends a message, it's that we're pretty serious, and this is. But I don't understand the need for camo in a city. Marvin, you want to jump in there? Marvin's looking at me, going, "Don't go there." I truly don't. I don't understand the need for camo in a city.
Well, coming from a background of the emergency task force, which is what we have in Rochester, I spent almost 10 years on. The uniform has evolved. I mean, we had the blackened out uniform years back that was synonymous to the SWAT movie. You know, you have the all black, and then
yep.
Their training at that time we used was the Woodlands or the camouflage. As far as what Ferguson's using, again, you have to try to look at both sides of the coin. Why is that uniform being deployed? Maybe that's all they have in the uniform because of the funds. They don't have enough money to buy the camos in a different color. Or maybe they're using it because they're trying to give some type of psychological appearance to those that they're deploying this in. Again, I would, like Professor Concordia was saying, I wouldn't deploy it regularly every day or for every situation, because you don't want to present that, that Occupy type atmosphere, that's what we're doing. We're coming as an occupying force and we're going to take over the city. But certainly the equipment, as far as the camouflage, if you're going to go into an area where you have a lot of foliage or cover to a household and you want to be able to have your members on the outside as a containment, stay concealed from the persons that's your target, then that's what you use it for tactically. If it's all black, all blue, it's all in what it does to help facilitate you being able to deal with the threat. Again, emergency task force was used for barricaded gunmen. They were used for high-risk warrants wherein we had to go in and help maybe the vice unit enter a home with a warrant that is known to have automatic weapons. Again, I would always say, when talking with the officers when I did the training out at the academy, because I was a firearms and defensive tactics instructor with Rochester PD, and what we would always talk about is that, we as the police department, we're controlled. The community controls us, okay? If they have a problem with the training or something, they can go to someone and pit, make a complaint against that, and we have to answer to it. The bad guy doesn't have to. The bad guy goes out and gets as many guns or any type of gun they want. They use it any type of way they want to use it and against whomever they want to. And so with that being said, a lot of times we have to have the equipment necessary, like the Bearcat or the MRAT, to protect ourselves when we have to go into that setting or that environment. So, you might not find a mine on the city street, but we have a lot of black powder fireworks that are bought across the border that are what we call M1s, or like Roman candles. They're all like little dynamite. These guys use those as part of their tactics, the Molotov cocktail. They use these things to attack one another. And if we don't have that equipment to protect the officers, then you don't have anything that can protect your citizens. Because, again, we're their first line of defense, and you have to have those things in place.
Attorney Dave Morabito, all that makes sense to you?
Well, I will defer to Marvin and Mark because they're the professionals. They're the ones who are trained in law enforcement. I'm just an average citizen, and it is very intimidating to see law enforcement dressed as, our infantry in the U.S. Army or Marines. I would like our RPD to be RPD cops, it's unfortunate that we're at that level where we need such aggressive, I don't want to say aggressive defense, but the show of force at times, unfortunately, has to be there to protect not only law enforcement but the citizens. And it's a sad commentary we're coming at, where we're going to. Now, it's my understanding that our U.S. military, when they were bringing weapons, vehicles from Afghanistan, Iraq, that they gave these vehicles and jeeps and other type of hardware to local law enforcement agencies. It's my understanding that our local agencies are not buying that. Is that correct?
For the most part, yeah. They're either purchased, they're donated, given to the local police departments through surplus military equipment, or these are being purchased through grants, like through Homeland Security. And they're not just vehicles. I mean, and this is not a new phenomenon. This has been occurring for the last two decades, where military equipment has been going to increasing numbers to local police departments. We're talking about armored vehicles. We're talking about aircraft, helicopters, night vision goggles, machine guns, weapons, and magazines. They're all going in there. Also tents. There's also medical equipment. There's also uniforms that were purchased through the last decade or two decades of military involvement overseas, and they're finding their way back to those local police departments. But we really do have to be sensitive of the message that it sends.
Yeah, and let me ask, because again, I don't want to get too far off on a tangent here, but I do want to get a specific yes or no from two retired officers who can answer this question. We see pictures from Ferguson where the officers have guns trained on people. They're holding guns and they're aiming the guns at people, whether it's demonstrators, someone walking down the street. Everything I've heard says that you do not aim a gun, a weapon, if it's loaded, unless you are really ready to engage, and that kind of behavior that we've seen in Ferguson is entirely inappropriate. But again, I'm not trained in this. Mark, Marvin, yes or no?
I would say that's inappropriate.
You've seen the pictures, right?
I saw the picture, and I believe that officer was actually suspended. You don't, you know, once again, you meet deadly physical. Once again, we have to, though, look at it from a broad perspective, right? A little bit objectively here. What was that officer feeling, sensing at the time? We only saw the video version of him pointing. Was there somebody standing in front of him with a weapon, whether a weapon be a club or a Molotov cocktail? We don't know the whole story. But if he was pointing his weapon system at an unarmed protester, that's unacceptable.
Agree, Marvin?
I can say yes, definitely, because, again, as a firearms instructor, you're always trained at the low ready. But, again, we're talking about a department that may not have the same level of training. And that's something that I found going across the country, that not every agency is trained the same way. We're not all equal. It's just like us sitting here at the table as a panel. We're all different in some respect. And so each department has a different level of training. And with that being said, this officer could have been caught in that split second by a camera, sweeping the weapon, moving the weapon, and this person at the angle that the camera took the shot, where that person seems or appears to be right in front. Again, now, if they are trained on the person, I would hope there's a weapon there so he can justify why he's up at the ready on that person.
All right, the bottom line is, Marvin is saying, if we're not there at that exact moment, let's try to at least give the benefit of the doubt that maybe there's something we don't understand, but it doesn't look good.
Right.
Okay. When it comes to military-style gear, one of the complaints is that if police departments have it, they will find a reason to use it. I haven't seen a whole lot of cases where people have said locally that was entirely inappropriate. But I called Dave last week, Dave Morabito, because I remember a case from 2005 in East Rochester. And I'll try to give you a little background factually, and Dave will fill me in where I'm right and wrong here. The background is that a 29-year-old school counselor named Phil Corletto wanted to open an open-air, sunshine, out-in-the-open poker club. Now, this was at the time when poker was on fire in this country. It was on ESPN, and it sort of still is, but it was online, it was everywhere. And we all know, in the media, there were, at least I knew, of plenty of places that were underground in the city of Rochester, poker clubs, et cetera, et cetera. And a friend of mine who frequented these places said, yeah, the police know where they are, but as long as we're not running drugs or hurting anybody, they leave it alone. Now, Marvin, I don't know if that's true, but that's what I was told. Phil Corletto says, I don't want to do it that way. I want to do it out in the open. I'm going to apply for a permit, the Village of East Rochester, right there on Commercial, right in the plaza, put your name on a board, open air, and let's have friends and family and neighbors and grandmothers come in. And he did. In fact, as far as I knew, he went through his attorney. They told the district attorney's office, you tell us if there's a problem here, and we'll shut it down. Well, instead of calling Phil to say it's not good, not cool anymore, one night, and I've interviewed many of the people who were in the room that night, there were maybe a couple dozen people playing poker at three different tables, and a bunch of officers in SWAT-style gear, helmets and everything, came screaming in the door, kicking over tables, and someone said to me, I was sitting next to a woman who looked like she could have been my grandmother, and I thought she was going to have a heart attack. And I could never understand why you needed a SWAT team to bust an open-air poker club run by a 29-year-old school counselor. And they paraded it like it was some big get, and I thought that was entirely inappropriate. Now, Dave, that was your case. Am I missing anything about those details?
There were a lot more details.
But was my description accurate, or am I being unfair?
You just hit a slight amount.
Okay.
What happened in this particular case, poker was becoming very popular nationally at that time. And this gentleman that you mentioned wanted to start a legitimate business. There were approximately 10 underground poker facilities going on at the time that everybody knew about, but they were in pretty rough areas. The average person did not want to go there. So Phil decided, let's legitimately open a poker club. He went to a prestigious law firm in the Rochester area. They did a corporate entity, got a charter from the Secretary of State. He went to, and his landlord went to the Village of East Rochester. They got a special use permit after advising what the business entity was going to be. They met with law enforcement, the building inspectors, the town attorney, the mayor, a few other people, trustees. They applied for that, got the special use permit. Everything was above and open. He paid his state and federal taxes. He had workman's comp for the employees, disability insurance. He went through paychecks for all the appropriate requirements to run a legitimate business. He had the bank accounts. And he wasn't what we call raking. He wasn't taking a percentage of the pot. And that's clearly illegal. What he was doing in this particular case, with everyone's approval from the state and local level, including Monroe County, was that he had an initiation fee, not an initiation fee, but a fee to come into the establishment. Once you came to the establishment, you could play poker, you could play chess, you could watch movies, you had food. So it was an entertaining entertainment. And a lot of people came, and they said that they wanted to go there because they felt safe. It was a very nice environment. It was for people to have fun, relax, and there were numerous issues about whether it was legitimate. And I did communicate with the district attorney's office, if there's any issues, communicate with law enforcement at the local and state level. Please come in, and we will turn over our books and let you analyze and critique.
They could have called at any time and said, got to stop, and you and your client would have stopped, yes or no?
Absolutely, yes. There was one issue as to whether or not he complied with a certain rule and regulation, so he stopped the business for 2 weeks. That was in December. It might have been 2004, 2005. And he closed the business down for 2 weeks, went through the reapplication process, got approval from everybody at all levels, and he opened it up again, and he didn't charge for a couple of months. He wanted to make sure everything was legally correct. And then we thought everything was legally correct, and one day a SWAT team appeared. He was arrested. I was not there at the scene, but I understand it was a very intimidating environment. And eventually he did go to trial. I did not represent him at the actual trial. I was taken off the day of the jury trial.
He lost his trial. You won the appeal.
And I won the appeal. Yeah. So everything was dismissed, but Phil had spent so much time and energy, he didn't want to reopen the
facility.
So he
gave it up. So now I know Mark wants to jump here. Go ahead, Mark.
This goes back to my point of the judicious use of this type of equipment. And what you may be describing here is more of a policy and procedure thing. A lot of departments may have policies and procedures that they will use a certain level of, whether it be their emergency service task force or maybe a vehicle like this, for felonies. And I think what the important byproduct of this discussion should be is a reevaluation of the regulations. I mean, even President Obama today ordered, in the Washington Post reports, he orders review of military equipment supplied to police. And there's going to be increased oversight and audit. And departments need to look at how they've articulated within their general rules and orders how we're going to use this. So they could say, well, that was a felony investigation, and we were serving a felony warrant, so this was necessitated.
Go ahead,
but
Dave.
I'm not sure if that was the case in this case. I'm not familiar with it. But this is going to need to really, really evaluate some of the policies and procedures on the use of this type of level of force.
In this particular case, it was a simple misdemeanor. It was not a felony. But again, I understand where law enforcement are coming from. There are certain times they have to have security to protect themselves and others in the immediate vicinity. So I'm not, as a criminal defense attorney or as a citizen of our community, I'm not at all in favor of law enforcement being placed in the position to protect themselves. I think that's critically important. We just have to have common sense and know when to use it.
Yeah, you don't oppose that them having this type of equipment. It's making sure that it's being used appropriately. I think that's what this conversation is about.
But it is very intimidating. I remember watching the horrible incident with the Boston bombing, and that was the first time I thought about militarization of law enforcement. And while I was watching that, and obviously this is a horrendous terrorist act, and it was despicable and unacceptable behavior in our country, But when I was as things evolved, I was seeing Boston police looking like way beyond SWAT teams, and it's kind of disheartening in some respects. But obviously, people analyze whether the actions were correct or not. I'm not going to sit here. I'm not a professional law enforcement to make final decision. Yeah. I'm just saying, as a citizen, it's tough to take sometimes.
All right. Now, Marvin, early in this hour, brought up the fact that the black community feels, in particular, a sense of mistrust. And I know we've talked about that in Rochester, and Mayor Warren has said they're working on it. If you look at Ferguson, here's a stat we've been hearing a lot. 63% black as a city, Ferguson, Missouri. 92% of the traffic stops or the police stops are for people who are black. 93% of the searches are black. 95% of the arrests are people who are black. Now, I'm not saying that that is ipso facto evidence of discrimination, but is that at least the starting point for discussion that says, hey, they're disproportionately stopped. Black people are treated with suspicion unfairly. Do you get that sense? As a retired police officer now in Rochester, are black people treated unfairly based on the color of their skin more often than white people, for example?
Well, it's difficult from a black perspective to say that white officers or white
citizens.
We're
going to get Mark on that in a second, but go ahead.
So I would have to say I can't tell you from the white perspective. I can tell you from the black perspective.
Yeah.
I can tell you as an officer, retired, and then as a black citizen.
Yes.
I've had two different experiences. The reason why you might see the numbers like they are is because there is a lack of understanding what the professor Concordia and I always talk about, the master narrative. What is the master narrative of the black community, and how does that voice become relevant to other communities? Because so far, we've seen from the 1920s on up to now a push and pull going back and forth where it looks like we're going forward, but then there's something that happens that sets us back. And here in Missouri, we can only assume that there was some type of lack of communication or understanding of the narrative between the officer and Michael Brown. And so because of that, Michael lost his life. Now, why are the stops like they are? Well, if you have a community that is predominantly black, there's going to be a higher percentage that those are going to be the folk that are getting stopped. What is the department doing about policing how the stops are orchestrated, or how the officer perceives the community? That's something that you have to teach within, okay, because you're going to have individual racism, you're going to have institutional racism. The laws have to be looked at again to see who they're addressing and what community are they enforced upon the most and why. The individuals have to learn that not only does my perspective matter, but those that I interact with that look differently than I matter. And when both sides are looking at one another equally, because we have to find the similarities between one another rather than the differences, that's what I teach with ethnic and social diversity. I don't start the class out with talking about what's our diversity, what's our differences, what's our similarities, because you'll be surprised how much more we are similar than different. And when you understand that and you appreciate that, then it'll be less likelihood that you look at that person across you suspectly or look at them, you know, with a leery eye. And that's what the Missouri is experiencing right now. It's something that has not changed in a lot of the southern regions and in some of the northern regions where it's a little bit more covert.
Is it better than that in Rochester? We hope it is.
Well, again, I think, you know, from my experience having gone throughout the city, in the suburbs as well, it's just a matter of ignorance. And you have some people that just don't understand and don't care to understand. They think what happens in my world is all that matters. And it isn't until they have to interact with another culture and get to understand that, hey, each culture is significantly important, and we have to embrace one another rather than say, you don't matter, you haven't mattered, and so I'm just going to go about my way and ignore what's important to you. Because right now, they're not ignoring what's going on in Missouri, because those folk are rioting. They're doing things that are bringing national attention, okay? And this conversation has been going on socially in the social media before it hit the mainstream. And that's because that culture, my culture, have communicated an injustice that they believe took place against them. And so they started the conversation. And then from there, it started to catch other ears who have found themselves to say, look, I'm going to find out about the other community that I live next to, because I want to know the black experience, the Asian experience, the Latino experience. Mm-hmm. I want to understand our similarities so that I don't go around thinking, oh, they're different. They breathe differently. They eat differently, because that's not the case.
I have less than 2 minutes left. Mark, go ahead.
Well, I think let's be clear. I think research has showed that people of color are stopped more often than whites. But, you know, what is the factors for those stops is a challenging point. And I agree with Marv. What we need to be really asking ourselves, and we continue to strive within the law enforcement community for better education, more inclusive training. What we have to understand is that not only, I mean, explicit displays of racism are not accepted at all in society or in the law enforcement community, but we have to be concerned with this implicit, okay? Subconscious biases that may be living and manifesting on discriminatory actions that have a negative effect on justice. And I think the question really needs to be asked is, what's happening in our streets? Is that a manifestation of implicit biases? And if it is, then we have to continue our education and self-awareness for our law enforcement officers, for the community, for our politicians, our judges, our lawyers. Self-awareness about, we all hold these prejudices. We do. I mean, studies and research, Harvard researching implicit bias tests, it's pronounced within the human entity.
About 40 seconds left. Most of your clients are black, Dave. And give me a sense for your experience with this question.
Well, with the question, I would note that the opinion I get from my clients, they feel there is racism. And I think Rochester, there are serious issues with race. And Marvin mentioned it's covert, but I think it's out there. I think we do have some serious problems in the city and also the suburbs. But I would note that as a criminal defense attorney, I have never, ever in 33 or 34 years, I've never noticed anything that was racially based from a judge, state or federal, from a state or federal prosecutor or a defense attorney. If the facts are there, somebody's convicted. If the facts are not there, they're acquitted. And I've never, ever seen race in the actual courtroom.
So you feel good about the system, at least.
From the courtroom,
from
yes.
From the courtroom forward, yeah. David, thank you for your perspective as an attorney. We could have done 2 or 5 hours on this. I want to thank our retired officers and professors at Wesleyan, Roberts Wesleyan College. That's Marvin Stefferson and Mark Concordia. Thank you to you both. Will you come back sometime and continue this conversation?
Absolutely.
I hope
Certainly.
You will. Marvin, thank you.
You're welcome.
Because there's so much that we barely even touched here, but we're going to continue to have the conversation with law enforcement or retired law enforcement. They're still working, though. They're both smiling. They're working. Thanks to you for listening. I'm Evan Dawson. This is Member Supported Public Radio.